Our reading this morning is from the beginning of Job. This is the start of a new series for us, looking at this book. So that starts on page 509 in the Church Bibles. Do find that if you have one. And we're going to be reading from chapter 1 and verse 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the peoples of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their home, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom.
One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands, so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord.
One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing.
On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied, "a man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, Very well, then. He is in your hands, but you must spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord
and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said.
If you're not regularly here, don't be surprised at what I'm saying now. And if you don't want to do it, you haven't got to. But I'd like you to spend a couple of minutes, if you feel able, talking to the person next to you or someone nearby you and saying, what struck you as strange or odd? What questions would you like to ask about that amazing piece of scripture we've just had read to us? Okay? If you didn't notice anything, then turn up again on page 509 in your Bibles, because it's one of the most unusual bits of the Bible, and this book we're about to study is one of the most unusual books. So if you feel able, talk to the person next to you. What questions does it raise for you about God, life, anything? Okay? If you don't want to talk and the person next to you does, just say to them, "I'll listen." Okay? Couple of minutes, off you go. Now, I'm just going to leave you there. I did think about asking people to shout out what they'd said, but I think that would be fairly chaotic. So we'll leave it there for now. But what I want to say to you is, hang on to these questions you've raised for the next about 7 weeks as we go through this series. Because this book is a book where the primary purpose, it seems to me, is to get us to ask questions and engage with them. And unfortunately, one of the reasons I don't want you all to shout out your questions is there's no way at all they're all going to get answered this morning, or possibly even over the next 7 weeks. But this is a fascinating book that we really, really are going to benefit by engaging with if we ask questions of it and of God. Let's have a look and see what we're going to do this morning. I'm due to give you an introduction to Job the book, Job the series, Job the man. There's a theme coming through here. And then we're going to look at the bits that really interest me, I think, for the day. Looking at a right perspective on things. How we look at the world. How we evaluate things. Then God's name and God's reputation. What's this story all about? And finally, a question to finish with. What does our love of God depend upon? And that's where we're going to finish today. Okay? So, the book of Job. Well, what do we know about it? Remarkably little, other than the fantastic 42 chapters we've got in the Bible. It's pretty old. It's one of the oldest books probably written in the Old Testament. Perhaps it was written at the time of the judges or the kings. Though if you go up to room 5, you'll see a war chart, and that says it could have been written even back in the time of Abraham. We're not too sure. There's lots of debate about when it was written. And it's quite interesting in that it is wisdom literature. In fact, I read to some commentator saying it is wonderful poetry. And the quote he said was, "This ranks amongst the most significant piece of world literature." So this is a really unusual book. Just as a matter of interest, can you raise a hand if you've ever had a series on Job in church before? Okay, one or two. There's about 6 or 7. But actually, looking around who they were, I bet that wasn't here. I don't think it's been preached in Fairfield for many, many years. Okay, so it's an unusual book, but one of the most significant pieces of world literature. And it's wisdom literature. It's not history. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it's simply lacking any of the things that might help us pinpoint when and where it happened. It doesn't refer to things like a temple or to priests, but there clearly is sacrifice. We read about that. So what's going on here is someone who believes in the one true God, living out their life, and we'll see, obviously, in the bit we're looking at today, things go catastrophically wrong. And that's what we're going to see. It says in verse 3, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Well, that could mean he came from China. But more likely, it means he came from the eastern bit of where the Israelites eventually settled. When the tribes came into the Promised Land, three of the tribes stayed in an area called Gilead, on the east of the Jordan. And it probably means that he came from that area. I did read someone who said that Uz might mean he came from Uzbekistan, but I thought that was a bit fanciful myself, I have to say. So that's what it's about. It's wisdom literature, and we don't know who wrote it. And that's all I can tell you about the book of Job. Now, our series on Job. So I'm going to talk under the title The Wager, although I'm not really going to talk much about The Wager today, in fact. Then we're going to look at Job's lament. Then we're going to look at four characters in the book of Job. Each who make a speech to Job to try and solve his problems, and Job then responds to them. So when it says Eliphaz, it's not just what Eliphaz said that we listen to, it's what Job responded that we look at as well. Then God speaks, and then finally Job responds to God. And it's, if all goes well, I'm doing the first one, and I could be doing the last one as well. So if I miss anything today, you feel unsatisfactory. For example, Job's wife is a great character, but I'm not going to talk about her today, but I might mention her at the end. We'll see how we go. There's a very good article, actually, in Today's Christian Woman website, not one that I look at regularly, but I did search on Job's wife online, and it came up. So if anyone's itching to look at Job's wife this week, go and look at search on Today's Christian Woman website, and I thought it was a very good article, actually. So, but we're not going to cover that today. But I'm going to tell you the two things that I hope that we as preachers of the book of Job are going to communicate to you over the next 7 weeks or so. And I hope this is right, but this is what Chris Wigram said we were meant to be doing, so it must be right, mustn't it? The first one is that God is in control. We often describe the book of Job as a book about suffering, and that's the second point. The righteous man is suffering in it, but the overarching theme is God is sovereign. God is sovereign. But also, we need to look at the situation of a righteous man who is suffering. I remember hearing a chap called Peter Cotterill, who that many of you will know, he shared two or three things with me that have stuck with me. And one of them was this. He said that, what have all religions got in common? And I wonder if you think about that, you might say, well, they're all about God, aren't they? Well, they're not. Buddhism, for example, is not fundamentally a religion about God. But all religions have got in common that they're trying to answer a question which in Buddhism is called dukkha. I think, if that's how you pronounce it, which is, why do bad things happen to good people? And that's the nub of what this series is going to try and address. Why do bad things happen to good people? As I've said, don't necessarily expect clear-cut answers. And challenge and question those of us who are preaching. If we seem to have missed the point or come up with a simplistic response or answer, come and talk to us. Tell us so. Because we shouldn't be doing that. But on the other hand, as you yourself look at this book, I think you're going to find here there's stuff here which is not easy, which doesn't naturally come out with a clear cut, oh yeah, that's an easy answer. Why? Because it's about real life. And real life doesn't have that many easy answers in the practical day-to-day, does it? Job the man. Job was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. In the passage we had read to us, thank you for the two readers, the passage we had read to us, that comes three times. He feared God and shunned evil. He was blameless and upright. I saw another joke online, actually, that I said he couldn't have been sinless, because it says in chapter 3, Job cursed the day he was born. And most kids can't talk till they're about two, so that's quite remarkable, isn't it? Sorry, that's meant to be a joke, by the way, but okay, bad one. But it's clear that Job wasn't sinless. So in Job chapter 9, he refers to his own sins of his youth. And obviously from the first chapter, where he's giving sacrifices on behalf of the sins of his children, he doesn't think he is without sin. But on the other hand, it's absolutely clear that God sees in him someone who is blameless, who lives a life truly devoted to following God. This is not something, when we get into the discussion about why does he suffer, that we can say perhaps he had lots of secret sins. That's not the message of this book. because God also declares Job. God it is who declares Job, first and foremost, to be blameless and upright. He fears God and shuns evil. That's what God says about Job. So this is a truly good man. And he was the greatest man among the people of the East. So he was someone who was rich and respected. In the new BBC test, he would have qualified as elite. I don't know if you've done your BBC test and found out whether you're traditional working class or elite or any of these seven new classes that come about, apparently. Those of you who are feeling upwardly mobile, go in and cheat on the answers and you can come out whatever thing you like. So go for it. But this man was one of the elite. He was really special in his society. Everyone looked up to him. He was rich. He was respected. And suddenly, catastrophe comes upon his well-ordered life. He loses his wealth. He loses his family, his children. And he finds everything is gone. And then a bit further on, of course, he even loses his health as well. Have you heard people use that throwaway line? Well, at least I've got my health. That's the phrase we use, isn't it, sometimes? For Job, he lost his wealth, he lost his children, and he lost his health. And that's where he is, sitting there. I want to talk about a right perspective on reality. About a month ago now, I preached from 1 John chapter 4. And more people probably responded and made comments to me and feedback to me after that sermon than any sermon I've preached in this church. Because I was focusing there on 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 to 6, where it talks about testing the spirits, and he who is within you is greater than he who is in the world. And I absolutely believe that there is a spiritual realm. And I absolutely believe that there is a conflict going on in that spiritual realm. But I want us to get that conflict firmly into perspective. There's a story told of a bargee who was dragging his barge along a very old canal towpath, and there was a donkey pulling the barge. And you may know that donkeys' ears, if they can't go underneath something, they won't go underneath it. And they came to this bridge, this is many, many years ago now, came to this bridge, and the donkey's ears were like this, and they were touching the top of the bridge, and so the donkey would not go through. And the bargee was looking at this and wondering what he could do. Anyway, the local village policeman comes along, and he peers over the bridge, and he says, "What's the problem?" And he says, "Look," he says, "this bridge is too low. My donkey's ears won't go under the bridge, so I can't carry on down the canal." And the policeman says, "I can see why you're only a bargee." He said, "Look, it's a muddy towpath. Why don't you dig a trench and then you'll be able to go underneath?" And the bargee looks up and he says, "I can see why you're only a simple village policeman. It's his ears that are sticking out, not his feet." It depends on your perspective. And if you look at things from the wrong angle, you will misunderstand them. And in this story about God and Satan, we are in danger if we're not careful at looking at things from the wrong perspective. And when we face difficulties in our life, we're also at danger of looking at things from the wrong perspective, from focusing on where we are at a point in time, rather than seeing the big picture, which is what God has got in mind. You see, what we've got is this conversation going on in heaven of which Job knew nothing. We don't know how the person that wrote the book knew about it, but it was given to them prophetically. Job is on earth and his world is collapsing around him. Job's worldview at the time was probably similar to what we might call prosperity theology today. Basically, that it was a bit like a slot machine. If you trust God, if you honour God, then you get blessed. You get blessed materially, your family gets blessed, and so on. And that was the mindset of him and his elite friends. It's a fairly good mindset for the elite. They always quite like it because they've got all the stuff, and so they say that proves that God's blessed us. It's a bit of a circular argument. But nonetheless, that was where they were coming from. That was the way they were thinking. But we have to see that actually going on in heaven was this very different situation. This situation where Satan is actually coming to God and, so to speak, provoking God. And we'll look at that again in a second as to what was actually going on there. But what it feels like from Job's perspective is that everything was fine and then suddenly everything is dreadful, is going wrong. A couple of things, first of all, about Satan. It's interesting, isn't it? This is not God and Satan equally struggling. God is in control. God is sovereign. Satan is called in to give account. Secondly, what do we read? Well, we read that Satan was going to and fro upon the earth. Well, what does that tell us? It tells us that Satan is not like God, who is everywhere. God is omnipresent. But Satan is in a geographic location and moving around. So God is everywhere, but Satan is going to and fro upon the earth. But it also probably tells us, and I think this is a discussion for another day, that there is perhaps a concept of territorial spirits. And I've heard it said, for example, that if you look at what's happened in the city of London, perhaps there is a territorial spirit of greed and corruption that has grown there, and that's caused great damage. We can pursue that another time. But I think there is a sense in which we need to see that it's not about God and Satan as equals having a fight, but God in control, Satan is called to account, and then we get this discussion about what's going to happen to Job. Let's think about it now from Job's perspective. And this is an analogy I'm sure you've heard before. If you look at the back of a beautiful tapestry, it looks a complete chaotic mess, doesn't it? All the knots, all the joins, all the loose threads. If you look at it from the front, it looks like a beautiful work of art. If you think about the spiritual realm and the earthly realm in that way, what God is looking at is the beautiful work of art that he is going to create in the life of Job or in the life of one of us. What we often see is the mess, the loose ends, the difficulties, because that's where we are. We're in the earthly realm. We who are Christians are aware of the spiritual realm, but we don't have God's perspective on what is going on that he has. The last thing I wanted to say at this stage was that remarkably, given how significant Satan appears to be in this passage, he doesn't appear in the next 40 chapters of the book. He's an irrelevancy. What matters is the relationship between Job and God. I'm not saying that Satan doesn't have power. I'm not saying he can't do damage. But I'm saying that what matters, the perspective for any human being, is not to focus on Satan, but to focus on God. Even when things are going really badly, or especially when things are going really badly, it is God that we need to relate to. It seems to me that this is a message that might apply to a number of us. Has your life worked out as you expected? I'm now in my late 50s. My life has not worked out how I expected in my mid-30s. And a number of you know a bit about my story and our story, and we've struggled with the fact that what we thought we would be doing at this stage of life, probably living in East Asia in Christian work, isn't what's happened. And now I go to Luton to help sort out customer service departments. So life doesn't always work out as you expect. How do you square that? Was I mishearing God the first time round when we went to Asia? Have we been disobedient? These are questions that clearly you have to ask yourself. They're quite valid questions. But what Job gives us is an insight into a critical truth, that actually what we intend and what God intends might be different. Do you remember the story of Joseph? And at the end of his father's life, when the brothers are coming very worried that he's about to turn on them and give them a terrible time, what does he say to them? He said, "You intended what you did to me for harm, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done." I don't know why I am not in Asia, but I do know that right now God has me here in Northwood Hills. And if we believe in redemption, not just as a one-off thing, but that at any point, wherever you are in life, that God can redeem the time and move you forward, we can then trust that God's perspective on our life and ours might be quite different, but we're called to trust and honour him. God is in charge, but in the story that we're looking at, there is a good man who God loves who is suffering. And yet God is in charge. Let's just take a moment of quiet to think about that as well. I mentioned on the last slide that Satan isn't mentioned again. Job could have perhaps been blaming Satan throughout the story. But the reality is, he turns on God and he demands to know from God, why? Why have I lost my children? Why has this terrible tragedy happened? Why am I ill? When it comes to the issue of suffering, the Bible doesn't want us to be blaming evil forces. The Bible seems to invite us to ask the questions why of God. That isn't irreverent. It isn't blasphemous. At the end of the book of Job, we'll discover that Job's ranting at God was an acceptable response as far as God was concerned, because he was at least ranting at God. And God can handle our rants. Whatever suffering, whatever situation you think you are in, God can handle it if you turn to him and you say, why? Why is this happening? You see, Job's God is still God, even when Job is suffering. And critically, he's still Job's God. And if you take nothing else from this service, perhaps that's what to take away. When things go wrong, where do you go with it? Go to God. God's name and God's reputation. This Satan-God discussion, very strange though it is, and I believe it is something which is given to help us sort of get an angle on it rather than necessarily a line-by-line discussion of a whole activity in the spiritual realm. But the basis of it is that actually Satan is saying, look, no man loves you or trusts you, God, for yourself. People trust God, Satan is saying, because of what they get out of it. So it's easy. If you get all this wealth and you get this great experience, etc., etc., that's why people trust you. Remarkably, and before we look at that, remarkably, God trusts Job. Not Job trusting God. God trusts Job with his reputation. God, you see, is a God of endless love. Satan cannot understand that someone could love. So therefore, all he can do is put a twisted motive against the behaviour of Job. But Job is trusted by God. And God says, look at my servant Job. He is blameless and upright. Even if he lost everything, he would still hold on to me. I believe that God actually trusts his reputation on us as well. And that's a really big challenge, it seems to me. How do we cope with it? But you think about it. People who know that you're a Christian, that's immediately God trusting his reputation with other people on you and me. How do we cope with that? Especially how do we cope with it when life is going wrong for us, which it does. What is all this about? I'm going to open questions at this stage. I don't mean to have an open discussion, but I'm just throwing up three things that have struck me that I think will probably be picked up over the next few weeks. Do you remember the story in John 9 of the man who was born blind? And this is what was said, which I think is really tough if you look at it just from a human perspective. Jesus and his disciples saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned? Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus' reply was, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in that man. If you look at that from just a human perspective, that sounds really cruel. That man was born blind so that as an adult, Jesus could do a miracle and give him his sight. That sounds cruel, doesn't it? But it was that man who was one of the first people in John's gospel who recognizes Jesus and it says, worshipped him. One of the first people to worship Jesus before he died and risen from the dead. Now, if you look at it from the spiritual perspective, what honor, what an amazing opportunity for that man. But from the worldly perspective, it looks like a tragedy. You might want to think about that. Second one, God trains and disciplines those he loves. I think when you look at what happens to Job, and I'll come back at the end and we'll see if we all agree, there's something going on that God is doing in him about developing Job as a human being, developing his character, his understanding. And there's a passage in Hebrews that says this, the Lord disciplines not the one he hates, but the one he loves. And he chastens everyone he accepts as his son. Endure hardship and suffering as discipline. God is treating you as his children. That seems really hard again if you look at it from a human perspective. But if you look at it from a spiritual perspective, God is working in us to bring about his glory, to bring about the image of his son in the way that we live, in changing the way that we live. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. We often talk about discipline, use the analogy of, say, an Olympic sportsman or whatever. I don't know if you saw the quote from a guy called Dan Evans. You probably don't know who Dan Evans is. If I say Andy Murray, okay, we all know immediately, great tennis player, okay? Dan Evans was playing this week for Great Britain in the Davis Cup, and he lost a 5-set game. And he was asked afterwards, he was playing there because Andy Murray was doing his preparation for other competitions, so Dan got a chance in the team. He's number 325 in the world. So you might think, oh, plucky Brit, lost again but tried hard. That would be our natural response. But this is what Dan Evans said. It's because I don't train hard enough and don't work hard enough day in, day out. I know that's the reason. I just don't do it. I'm pretty obviously bad at my job. And he lost in the 5th set. Now, all credit to him for candor. But what he's saying is, actually, I know that if I trained, if I did that work, I could be a lot better. Now, I'm just turning that around in terms of this picture of God disciplining us, God training us. If we react to everything that happens to us, good and bad, and we go against God and we curse him and we say, what's going on? I hate this. You should be looking after me better. If that is our response, we're effectively getting no benefit other than bitterness from the situation that's happened. If we are able to hold on to God and see him in that, perhaps that's the discipline and training that we need. And then finally, there's a promise too, isn't there, that God never tests us or takes us beyond what we can bear. 1 Corinthians 10:13, God is faithful. He will not let you be tested beyond what you can bear. But when you are tested, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. And because we have the whole story of Job, we can see that was true in Job's situation as well. Let me finish by asking you this. On what does our love of God depend? Is it self-interest? Many of us, as David prayed earlier, can thank God for many blessings that we've had materially and emotionally and socially. And most of us living in this country would say that we have had many blessings from God. And every good and perfect gift is from above. We should thank him when the Lord gives. But how would we respond if the Lord takes away? How would we cope with that? I recognize that we're not probably the same character as Job was. But nonetheless, there is a challenge to us, isn't there? Are we following Jesus just because so far it's been good socially or materially? Or if those things were taken away, would we still hold on in love and faith and trust to God the sovereign, even though we didn't understand or like what was happening? On what does our love of God depend? Do you remember the 1 John 4, verse 19? We love because he first loved us. Whenever we think about suffering and we think about holding on to God, the only place that that makes any sense is at the cross. The sense that we do not come to a God who is not able to understand, to empathize, to recognize what we're going through. But we come to a God who sent his son himself to die on the cross for us. He rose again, praise God. But he went through the valley of the shadow of death. He went through the suffering. So that when we are suffering, when we are facing those things, we are not just praying to someone who can't understand, but to someone who loves us and gave himself for us. Can we join to sing our last song, which is Oh, the Deep, Deep Love of Jesus? This was written by a guy called Samuel Francis in the 1850s. It was written about after that, but in the 1850s, he was a young man standing on a bridge in London contemplating suicide. He had had enough of life and he could see no point to it. And at that point, he had an overwhelming spiritual experience of the love of Jesus coming into his situation. Let's join and sing, Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, as we grapple with the problems and the challenges of the righteous man suffering. God is in charge. Amen.